Welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. We've got the full crew here once again. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Hi.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Glazio.
Hey, folks.
And Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
So I know it's been kind of a hectic couple of months in the summer. We've had people out doing events at Anime Expo. We've had people out for vacations. We've had a few other things, but here we are in the middle of July with the full crew here once again. So I want to thank Josh, Adam, and Chow for holding down the fort last week while me and Josh were out. Sorry, me and James were out. So James was at Anime Expo, and we're going to be talking a fair bit about that over this podcast. This podcast doesn't have a huge itinerary in terms of specific headlines, but we've got up a few previews. I'll talk about my time away. I was at Denver Fan Expo on vacation, but there was a few gaming tangential things, and I'll just blab about it. We've played a few games. We've had a lot of releases in late June, early July. So we'll just kind of wing it, play it by ear about this podcast. I'm not exactly sure where it's going to go, but we'll see. So before I start out here, just James, welcome back. I was looking at the podcast document here, and you've been just a machine putting out previews and interviews and just writing down about your time at Anime Expo and what you saw and what you have yet to talk about. I'll just kind of give you the microphone and talk about your time in LA and what you saw over at the event there.
So I've been very busy the last week, and I'm still busy because I've got stuff that I'm working on that's separate from the Anime Expo stuff throughout this week. Anime Expo was probably the busiest one I've had this year. I did three interviews. One of them was a bit bigger, and that should be going up sometime this next week. Interviews for it have gone up at Ever Outlet. So I can just say I once again had a chat with Falcon president Toshihiro Kondo, and actually had an interesting sort of interview situation this time around, but you'll have to wait and see when that goes live. I don't have any specific time frames for it, but it should be, I imagine, this next week. I once again spoke with the Spike Chunsoft folks about their announcements. I live tweeted their panel where they announced, I don't think we've decided for covering or not yet, Natsumon 20th Century Summer Kid, which is like a spiritual successor to the Natsuya Tsumi series. That was neat. Got some really interesting info from them during that interview, and also some context for what the hell is going on with the localization for Master Detective Archives Raincode Plus. And I also talked with Taichiro Miyazaki at CyberConnect 2 again, and also got some interesting information there, like the fact that Fuga Melodies of Steel 3 is probably going to be 40 hours long.
That's a long game compared to its predecessors.
Interesting
to see how that shapes up, because they showed like the first footage of that at like AnthroCon.
Yeah, they also showed the same footage at Anime Expo, okay, and cool. They're still deciding what venue the next announcement is going to take place at, but it is scheduled for the fall, so probably somewhere like October, November.
So I imagine they're going to show at Tokyo Game Show for sure.
No, because that would still be in the summer. They have an idea of where they want to show it in mind, but I don't know if they want that to be public yet. Just not going to say it. But
okay.
All I will say is that they were very happy with the reception to the AnthroCon reveal. So make of that what good. You will.
Yeah.
Also, I played a bunch of demos for games at Anime Expo. First off, Phantom Brave, The Lost Hero, that was playable. It was only announced like a week and a half, two weeks ago. Yeah,
that's like a coming next year still, so I imagine, you know, I imagine you're playing like the Switch build.
They had both the Switch build and the PlayStation 5 build. I took one look at the Switch build, saw that it still didn't run great, and I was like, I'm gonna play it on PS5, and that ran great.
Okay, cool.
It ran great. It's still very early build, mm-hmm. so there are some stability issues. Yeah. Very unfortunately, I cast a fire spell, and then the game crashed, and I was like, oh. Which, for context of anyone that doesn't know why that is notable, is there was a very infamous crashing issue with NIS America's release of Disgaea D2 back on the PS3, where casting a fire spell had a very high chance of crashing the game.
I've heard so much myth about that game, about how it would like corrupt your hard drive and stuff. It's like, oh man.
I'm sure most of that is just complete nonsense, but still, besides the instability, which again, not the final release. It's not coming out until next year. I believe they're targeting early 2025, from what I understand. So that's okay. So it's still like at least like 6, 7, 8 months away. So it should be fine. It should be fine. But it looks and runs great. It seems like that's something to look forward to next year. But I also played a bunch of other stuff. I played Raynatus. I put up a preview about that. I thought the combat was very interesting in the sense that it was very different from other combat systems and action RPGs I've played. And I kind of went over hows and whys in my preview article, but just to kind of sum things up, you have two states. You have suppressed state and liberated state. You can only dodge in suppressed state, but you can basically do a perfect dodge. Like what happens is if you're about to get hit, a symbol will flash on the screen. If you hold down the dodge button and then let go at the right moment, you'll be able to do a counterattack and basically instantly go into liberated state with a full magic meter. You can only stay in liberated state as long as you have magic, and using your special attacks will consume more magic than just passively using your standard attacks. So sometimes it might be a case where you're about to get hit by an attack, so you willingly switch back into suppressed state so you can just like counter that immediately. And it's interesting. It's very interesting. You have multiple characters. Well, I was only able to play two, but they said you can have parties of up to three and can switch between them at any time. So I'm feeling good about this. I feel like this has some potential here.
I'm cautiously, I don't know if optimistic, but I'm cautious about it because, you know, we know how Furio.
Yeah. But it's like, it seems promising, mm-hmm. more so than the usual Furio project. So that's something. That's all the NIS America stuff I played, but I did check out the Switch version of East Memoir Ofenfelgana, and that's like, yeah, that's Ofenfelgana. It runs fine, at least in the setup they had in docked mode. It was very early on, but it's like, this is a modern version of this game with technically...
You would hope it runs well.
yeah. I mean, it's like, what? It was released in 2003 originally or some shit?
I played the Japanese version. It's like the best version of East Ofenfelgana, in my opinion.
Yeah, the one thing I'm curious about, and I didn't get like a straightforward answer from them, is I wonder if the PS5 version allows for 120 FPS, because it should. Like, there's no reason it shouldn't be able to, but good version of the game. If you want to play Ofenfelgana and you don't want to play it on PC, like, this seems like it'll be a great way of doing so. I also played some other stuff at Xseed's booth that I didn't write up previews on. I will say that I was not very impressed with the Corpse Party 2 preview they had set up. I'm not sure if it was just the section that they showcased or if it was the game itself being kind of eh. There was a few things that I thought definitely needed work, and I gave them some constructive criticism, like, hey, I feel like there should just be a single button you can press to open up the map instead of having to go into the menus and then like scroll over to it. It feels like, especially if there's going to be puzzles with trying to find your way through it, it might be a good idea to try and like get some sort of like quick access button to that map, which I think is fair. But yeah, I also played Card and Seal at Idea Factory's, not Idea Factory, fucking Integreates. Idea Factory wasn't even there this year. They had their own separate thing, which I guess we will talk about that stuff later, what they had for announcements. Or you did last
week. We talked about it last week because it was literally announced during our podcast.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, so Integreates, they had a demo of Card and Steel, and I was really impressed by that. I would say it was my game of the show, even if Anime Expo isn't predominantly a gaming like convention. I was really impressed with it.
That is a pretty interesting upcoming. That's sort of like the almost like the Mega Man Battle Network-ish game, but then like the premises, there has like in-game original characters that are like integrated into it. I'm not saying it's exactly one-to-one, but that's just like the initial impression that you get.
Yeah, it's definitely. It's definitely like the window dressing is very similar to Battle mm-hmm. Network. But if you actually like once you play the game and see the battle system, it's like, oh, this is like almost like completely different mm-hmm. because you don't have free movement. Instead, it's like a true turn based where it's like you have your deck, you have your like hand of cards, and it's like, OK, you have a certain amount of energy and each card has a certain energy cost, but also the enemies will have attacks that they'll have a timer on, and you'll have like AOE markers on your side of the grid to let you know this is where the attacks are going to hit. So sometimes you're going to have to move out of the way, but the only way you can do that is that every card that you have in your hand also has a movement that'll let you move in if you discard it. So there's like a play there where it's like, okay, which cards do you want to use? Depending on like what energy do you want to spend and when, what impacts you want to make and when. And then it's also like, okay, some cards you might want to use for attacks, but you really need it just in case you need to move in a specific direction, because this is the only card in your hand that lets you move in that direction if you discard it. And then there's a bunch of other stuff that I went over in my preview, but it's like, there's a lot of different like moving parts in the combat system. And the fact that it was able to kind of slowly like key you into them over the course of the like 10-15 minute demo, where it wasn't overwhelming, but you could feel, oh, there's a lot of depth here. That's a sign of a really good demo. It was a really good demo.
Yeah. I'm interested to hopefully get around to it when it launches later this year. It seems to be a really, really interesting project.
Man, doesn't that release right on top of East 10? Because it's October 24th or something.
Oh, well, then probably.
You've also got Romancing Saga 2 around.
Yeah, October sucks.
Yeah, we're like October. In the one quiet part of the year until it just goes crazy again.
Oh, it's a quiet part of the year if you don't play VR games, because apparently this week is when everyone was releasing their VR stuff. Swery released a new game and it's exclusive to VR.
Well, okay. I didn't even know he had a VR game. I didn't know Swery was working on a VR game.
Yeah.
I know they're working on that side scroller action like horror theme, like Tarantino inspired game. I don't know about the VR.
Yep. It's a VR game called Death Game Hotel. And it came out literally a day or two ago.
Okay.
And if you're curious, the other VR games that came out this week that I'm alluding to is the Exudate VR, which is incredibly, like, it makes sense. Like,
oh yeah, that's a perfect fit. For sure. Yeah.
Also, this kind of like point and click adventure puzzler called Infinite Inside, which is pretty neat. But yeah, those three games alone, and then there's also some other stuff next week. So it's like,
it never ends.
Yep.
Yeah. So anything else? Like, I wish I could go back to Anime Expo. Like, but since I moved out of state, it makes it trickier to go there. But
There was at least one other game I previewed. I'm trying to remember what it was. One second.
I was able to watch some of the panel stuff, like the Fate Grand Order panel. They didn't really announce anything new there, but
I was hoping they would have had an announcement. Yeah. But yeah.
But there's a lot of like fun panels to watch for sure that they live stream.
Right. I did play Gundam Breaker 4. You would have been the better person to preview it.
It's okay.
I played a bit of 3, and from what I saw, it's like, this seems really neat. It seems like this has a bit more of a budget, and it seems like it's focusing on the right things. It's like, oh yeah, in the lobbies, you actually control the Gunpla, so you can show off your sick builds. And it's like, awesome. You understand the assignment.
Yeah, that makes sense. they're holding like a open beta test later this upcoming week.
Yeah,
get my hands onto that again. Yeah, I'm really, really excited for that game. It's end of August. I'm wishing for the best, man. I really am hoping this is the one that, like, I don't know. I'm ready to sink hundreds of hours into it.
Yep. And it is crossplay, right? I believe.
I don't know if it's crossplay. They haven't said anything. I don't think it is. They would have said something by now. The thing that I thought it'd be crossplay, because there's like a player profile cards with like distinct IDs, like ID numbers for those, and I was like, is that crossplay? But they've never officially explicitly mentioned that there's crossplay in that game. And I figure if it had it by now, they would say something officially, but they haven't said that.
Yeah, I know I asked about that, but I forgot what the answer was.
Oh, no. That would have been big.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, they'll, if it's there, it's there. If it's not, it's not.
No. Obviously, it can't be important if you don't remember what it is.
Hmm. Yeah, obviously.
Everyone I know is going to play on PC, because fuck PlayStation Plus.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah, we're getting canceled.
Hey, man, I mean, look, there's one platform that you don't have to pay for to play online, so.
I have swore off these things, like, I don't know, like a decade ago. I was like, you know, why am I paying $60 a year back in those days?
I got an email from Microsoft about my, like, auto-renew for, like, Microsoft Rewards to get, like, a month of Game Pass Ultimate pretty much every month, because I use Bing, because it's, like, at this point, it's, like, hit or miss if it's better than Google, so it's, like, exactly, whatever. Yeah. Might as well get the reward points. And they said, oh, yeah, we're no longer doing this anymore. It's like, cool, I am no longer being subbed to Game Pass Ultimate because I am not paying $20 a month. You've got to be insane.
Yeah, the whole Microsoft the Xbox Game Pass news this past week has been insane, crazy. But, you know, but not unexpected after announcing that Call of Duty was coming to Game Pass. But yeah, anything else from Anime Expo, James? Do you, like, I imagine there's just like a large amount of bodies still there, just every year, just a shitload.
Yep, just a shitload.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's cool. You know, I mean, yeah, and I had some friends go, and they seemed like a lot of fun too. So it's great. I think the one thing I wish someone that I knew did was they had this VR setup for Fate. Where you put on like a VR headset and then you get to like reenact the Gilgamesh fight with Shiro. It sounded extremely corny, and I wish I knew someone that did it and tell me how it was. Because that seems funny.
Yep.
I won't spend as much time on this as James spent on Anime Expo because it was just a personal vacation, but I went to Denver Fan Expo, which is basically Comic-Con. Fan Expo is the name of the group that owns it, kind of like Repop, and it's more of a comic and movie expo. There was a small gaming presence there, in terms of like actual exhibitors or panels. Focus Entertainment was there with Space Marine 2. Deck Nine was there talking about their mocap like technology. There was some like peripheral manufacturer there that was hosting tournaments, like there was Street Fighter 6 and Smash Brothers. But what I more wanted to comment on, just very briefly here, is obviously there's a lot of fan art, a lot of cosplay, and just kind of seeing like all the gaming representation there, because it's mostly Western comics, a lot of anime too. And we've talked about this obviously on our podcast because it's right in our wheelhouse. But until I went to Fan Expo, I did not realize. I mean, I guess I realized it, but not to the extent how much Baldur's Gate 3 I saw. It was everywhere. Every single artist alley booth had the whole party, like people did their portraits in the different style. I think I saw like 3 Karloks, 2 Asterions, like in terms of costumes. Like it was just everywhere, like alongside like people doing art for like Zelda and Star Wars and Lord of the Rings, like Baldur's Gate at that level. It was just like, damn, like I knew it had kind of broken out of the, I don't know if broken the mold's the right word, broken into the mainstream, but it kind of solidified how much I saw that. And then on the other side of the pond, Genshin was everywhere. It was all over the place. And mm-hmm. I actually, one of the friend group people that I went with, who does not play Genshin, ended up buying some Genshin art just because she really liked the art style of the fan art who did it, fan artist nice. Who made it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was basically what I kind of cued in on when I was looking at what was there. And obviously there was a lot of properties in terms like Final Fantasy was pretty present. A lot of 14, a lot of 7 Rebirth, a remake, a little bit of 16. I imagine there would have been more last year. Of course, there was a few specific fan arts who like covered every single game in that series. In terms of anime, there was a lot of Jujutsu Kaisen, a lot of Chainsaw Man. Out of all the older properties, I think there was still like Naruto still has a lingering presence. There's a lot of Naruto. Cosplay and art. So I don't know. I had a good time. It was just interesting kind of just to see like, because these are alongside people dressed as like Spider-Gwen or Avatar The Last Airbender characters. Like, it's
for
a really...
For all intents and purposes, like, there's kind of, like, a normie-focused sort of convention, say, right?
It's... And I say that as a normie, but, like, yeah, most of the panels were Western animation, comic book, movie-focused, so there were plenty of voice actors. And also in the Baldur's Gate 3 thing, like, they had, like... a lot of recognizable voice actors like Justin Briner, Roger Craig Smith, Patricia Somerset, who does Zelda, but like, and then Charles Martinet and a bunch of others, Donnie Young Bosch. But the voice actor for Astarion, who I'm blanking on the name right now, Richard Newbin. I'm gonna look this up real quick so I don't screw it up. Neil Newbin. I don't know why I thought it was Richard. Neil Newbin. His line for like autographs or just chatting or whatever was huge, like 8 times the length of any other line. Just because he was Astarion. Yeah. And I'm not saying that's wrong or incorrect. It's just seeing his line next to Johnny Young Bosch or
that's the nature of the business. And it's like whoever's the popular at that time will obviously get, you know, more attention.
Yeah. And there was more anime or video game representation in the fan art and in the comic book and in the cosplay, I mean, compared to like the actual panels, but it wasn't absent everywhere else. It was just slanted the other way. But I saw everything from all over the place. My favorite, this is a little bit of a deeper cut. My favorite is there were people dressed up as like the puppets from that British, like don't touch me, I'm scared or something like that. It was like a web show from like 10 years ago. And I've only ever seen it once because it kind of puts you on edge, but there are people dressed up as like the spaghetti monster guy. And I'm probably describing it very poorly for those that really love that, but very kind of a deep cut. Like, I was not expecting to see you here. And there are also like Western animation, like Owl House and Over the Garden Wall and things like that. So I won't linger too much longer on that, but it was a good time. Was able to like just do something that was not related to work. And it was just my friend group. And did get to see a little bit of a gaming presence there. So that's why I wasn't here last week, but I had a good time. And
I have an important question for you about this. Were there any good like restaurants or food places you went to there that like left an impression on you?
Oh yeah. I'm going to blank on the name now that you put me on the spot, but we went to, it's in Denver. Mm-hmm. I'm blanking on all the names now. We went to a really good taco place. It's like this is the most terrible comparison, but like a Chipotle, only actually good.
I like Chipotle, so okay.
Sure. I do like Chipotle. I live near one and I eat there way too often. But it was like,
Brian, you should get us the Street Fighter 6 promotion from there.
Yeah, and that was I think someone who sold like fight sticks and peripherals, and they were just doing a bunch of tournaments that you could sign up for.
Nice.
So not actually Capcom or Nintendo, but there was a Street Fighter tournament and a Smash Bros. Tournament, and I think they were playing something else too.
Cool.
We went to a very good Indian restaurant. We went to a kind of like a bar that was focused on like tabletop gaming, where you could like rent out like a gaming table that has like the drawers that pull out that you can put like your deck mat. When I say tabletop, I mean like Magic the Gathering, like or like any tabletop. You could use it for anything. But yeah, we basically ate out every night, and it was a good time. Spent way too much money. I got some fan art for my walls. A lot of people got different keychains or stickers or little notebooks or bags, or you know, it's a 4-day event, and the whole Merchant Artist Alley area is like ginormous. It's like a giant warehouse. And anyone who's been to PAX or Comic-Con or any of those kind of knows what I'm talking about. And there's the talent on display is just insane, both in terms of like costumes and just art and everything.
It's like a tree hall, like an anime expo, where like that's where all the fan booths live. You know, a lot of that's always packed 24/7 at anime expo, but it's up. It's always like a trap, like to go there, because like you obviously want to go see any cool new art or support, like, you know, your favorite fan artist there. But it's also just like you have to plan sort of like a chunk of your day around, because you're going to be there for hours trying to move through it.
Yeah,
pretty much. But it's always worth it, you know. It's definitely a lot of foot traffic there, but it's people always bring their like their best there as well.
We were there 4 days, and I spent time in the artist, they called it the Artist Valley. I spent time there each day. Like, I was never bored, and there was so much to see. And it was just like a... I have one anecdote I'll share. I'm spending longer on this than I intended, but our slate of news is a little bit small, so it's allowed. I was looking for art from one of my younger brothers, and there was this guy who focused on doing vertical art of different spaceships, everywhere from Star Wars ships to the Enterprise to Mass Effect and Battlestar Galactica, basically every property. And this is gonna be a ding to my RPG cred if I have any. But they had all the different versions of the Normandy from Mass Effect, and there were two different versions of the Normandy SR2. And I'm like, remind me. I'm asking the artist this, the guy who made this. I'm like, remind me, what's the difference between these two? And then without dropping a beat, he's like, oh yeah, that first one's when it's owned by Cerberus, and then the second one is in Mass Effect 3 once it's taken back by the Alliance. And he immediately just went off like he knew his shit. And I was like, oh yeah. So I got one of those for my younger brother. One other thing I didn't say is that I've been replaying Elden Ring. I have not gotten to the DLC yet because I was in New Game Plus and I had to replay a bunch of the game, and I'm still in the middle of that. But there was a lot of Elden Ring there, a lot of what you'd expect, a lot of very creative Melania's and Franny the Witch and a few others. There was a few Radons and a few other things. Mm-hmm. My favorite was this one person who did I don't know if mosaic is the right word or fresco, but they did a very specific style for different, like the, I forget if they call them demigods or the godborn, but those characters in Elden Ring, they had one with Melania in the back, but in the front, it was a very lightly dressed man with a pot on his head because it's let me solo him. Fan art. And I was just awesome. Like, oh, this person, I love it. This person knows, like, this person is, didn't just like look up characters on a wiki and draw them. Like, this person knows. And that's the vibe I kind of got from all the artists, is that they all were very passionate about, this is going to sound a little bit floofy, but it's something I believe in. Like, all these artists are very passionate about what they do. Mm-hmm. Regardless of the property it is. And there's a lot of cool original art as well. And I always try to give them as much, because you could just kind of tell people like gravitate towards the IPs that they know, recognize, or like. And a lot of the original art just had smaller crowds because, you know, you walk by it and you're like, I don't recognize that. Because
you're unfamiliar with artist.
Yeah. And so I made sure to spend some time actually looking at some of the original art. People that were like amateur or just newly professional making their own graphic novels. There's this one person who had this whole art set about Pumpkin Man, who is just like a man that has a pumpkin on his head. Like, I don't know. Sorry, I'm stuttering here.
It's okay.
What? There's like an old like cartoon about like a guy that has a pumpkin on his head that rides. I'm trying to remember what that is. But it was it was like a kind version of that, and he was, it was just Pumpkin Man walking through and like watering his garden or like grooming his dog. And it was just like, I appreciate this. Just kind of like cozy original art. And if someone asks you what it is, it's like, it's not from anything. It's just an artist that I vibed with at Anime Expo, at whatever expo. And you know, had an affinity towards and decided to support. So
it's cool.
That was my time at Denver Fan Expo. Of course, I did bring my Steam Deck and was trying to play Elden Ring in the gaps, or the Daybreak came out on the 4th and or the 5th, whenever it came out. So I just had started that while I was away, like when we were back at our Airbnb and things like that. But anyways, had a good time. It was cool to see all the different characters from all the different properties intersect and intermingle. Definitely enjoyed it more coming out of it than I expected going in.
Okay, that's cool. I mean, I don't know most about like it's cool to get that perspective because, you know, we talk about, you know, when E3 was still a thing, like that was like definitely one of the biggest conventions that we knew, Anime Expo, of course. But like, it's cool to hear the perspective, like lesser known regional convention experiences and like what, like, you know, what they have, like, you know, because for in our purview, usually, like, we only know like the most biggest ones, like Comic-Con.
Yeah, like San Diego Comic-Con.
Yes, yeah,
like and like, I'll be honest, when I was reading like the panel list, this is the last thing I'll say. When I was reading like the panel list and the exhibitors, like the official exhibitors and things like that, it's a lot of Marvel, a lot of comic book. And I was like, I don't know if like that's just not what I'm into. But then once I was there, you see all the costumes and the fan art and the you know, the people who are going there to visit. And it was a lot more even spread. Like, there was so many people there that regardless of what you were interested in, you were going to find your people.
story. Yeah, you're there more for community, more so than like, you know, big new announcements, you know, the major announcements or anything like that.
And like, really there like for community. And one of the people I traveled with, like the person that bought the Genshin art, traveled there with cosplay of Toph from Avatar: The Last Airbender. So that was what she was into, but walked away with Genshin fan art. So that's kind of like a microcosm.
That's fascinating. Yeah, so, that's cool. Yeah.
Anyway, so thanks for allowing me some time to go on that tangent.
So, since we're on the topic, you know, just recently you finished Daybreak. Since we're already here, and you just did it like minutes before this podcast started.
Yeah, I just got through the credits. Yeah,
so I guess there's the best time to ask you, like, what are like your first gut takeaways from what you played?
Yeah, sure. So I feel a little bit like, oh, that's cute, Brian. You're just now playing Daybreak when everyone else is excited about Kaino Kiseki or things like that.
No, definitely not. You're representative of like the Western fan base here. You are the voice of the people at the West. No pressure.
All right, so yeah, so I just played through Daybreak the first time. I was using Chao's guide on Neo Seeker. So shout out to Chao to make sure I get all the treasure chests and battle arts and things like that. I'm trying to think of where do I tackle this from. First of all, I'll just say, like, bottom line up front, it's in my top five of the series for sure. I don't think it beats my favorite has always waffled between Trails Third and Trails from Zero. And then I like Cold Steel 2 a lot as well, and kind of like that third, fourth spot. And that's where I think Daybreak is. I'm when I played through Reverie last year, I was just zoned out. Like, I was, this is a little bit honest, I was just bored of the characters, bored of the setting. Like, I described it as Cold Steel 5, which is not that generous, but it's kind of how I felt at the time. And I was just like, I just need a change of scenery, and at least in a small way. And Daybreak provided that. Like, thank goodness. Like, different people, different characters, at least to the most extent. And I also just like how the stakes were reined in a little bit. Like, it starts out with like a murder mystery, and it's, I also just like that it's not framed around field expeditions. Like, the story moves a lot more naturally from chapter to chapter. So at a high level, those are the things I really liked just about like the framing of the game. Though I am very glad that I've played the series up to this point. We've talked about in the past, like, is this a good starting point or not? And it definitely is, but also there are lots of callbacks or winks and nods to previous games. Some that I really liked because it made a lot of sense, and some that I didn't dislike, but I kind of felt, here, I'll describe it. There's a few, I'm not going to talk about specific story events in the game because I know the game came out about a week ago in English for the first time officially, and people are still playing through it. So I'm not going to talk about like where the story goes. I'll just talk about the premise of like the cast and like the location of Kalvard. From chapter to chapter, it's still got if you've played any other Kiseki game, it's still got the same like progression.
Structure,
yeah. The way that it goes through. You pick up quests from notice boards. You have time in each chapter. It typically introduces you to a new location. You can talk to a lot of NPCs. NPCs will kind of change their dialogue depending on how far you've progressed in that chapter. Each chapter introduces a new party member. It's not perfectly one per chapter, but it's pretty close to that. But it just feels a lot more organic because the Cold Steel I never quite liked, or it's like, this month's field expedition, we're going to this town because that's what the curriculum says. And maybe that's not super generous, but it always felt a little bit artificial. Where here is more like, hey, we've got an objective based on the unfolding story that requires us to be in this new location in Kalvard, so we're going to head there. It just felt a lot more like, that makes a lot more sense. I like that. Vaughn, I really do like as a character, just being slightly older. By older, I mean like he's still 24. I know that Scott, who is our reviewer, did compare him a lot to Yuri Lowell from Tales of Vesperia, and I don't think that's a bad comparison. It's not perfect, but it's a good launching point if you're just trying to describe this character to someone that someone might already know. So he has a lot of experience, but he hasn't been kind of like on stage previously in the series, so it's kind of interesting just to see that fresh perspective where he's still a veteran in what he does, but he's not someone that has like a lot of baggage or like preconceived notions about who he is or what he values. So you kind of learn that as you learn to know him and the cast will learn that alongside the player.
And that's a pretty that's a pretty good like observation and like the contrast to that, because you think about like the first games of each arc of Kiseki, and it's usually like Estelle, like, you know, a very fresh new bracer on the job. Lloyd, first day on the job as a cop. Green, basically, you know, first day at school, and so forth. And this one is like, as contrast to those, you know, this is someone who's, as you mentioned, already experienced, but not like super, super veteran status.
Yeah, and there's plenty of times throughout the... Go ahead.
I don't even know if I'd agree with that, because like one of the running gags throughout like all of Daybreak is there someone you don't know? It's like, wait, you were involved with that? So yeah, I think he's a veteran.
Yeah, I was just going to get to that. Like he was a veteran, but like off screen or behind the scenes in a lot of ways, because he would be like, yeah, I ran into this important character on a job 2 years back, or yeah, I had a run in with this person unexpectedly. And let me recount that story. And so basically he was kind of like, everybody knows Vaughn, but not to an extent that annoyed me in any way. It feels like when I describe it, like I could get on your nerves, like, oh, everyone knows Vaughn or Van, I guess they pronounce it. My brain wants to correct it to Vaughn, but they pronounce it Van. And so that there is a little bit of that. So he does stay well connected, which makes sense for like the role that he occupies, like both in the world and in the game as the protagonist. So I did enjoy that a lot. I actually, on a more gameplay focused thing, I wasn't sure how I would feel about the combo action / command style gameplay, but I actually ended up really liking it a lot. I think they balanced it very well, where you are actually like, you are encouraged to go into command mode. I think that's what they call it in game. The classic turn-based mode with the positioning based on your arts or crafts, because it actually is a lot more efficient than the action mode. But the action mode can give you some bonuses if you stun the enemy before going into command mode, or if you switch characters, or if you time your dodge like a perfect dodge me style. So you get into this really fun rhythm of like, there's an enemy on the field, I'm going to swing at them, dodge around them, try to get the stun off, and then go into command mode and then do a craft or whatever. And it feels really good. I think they balanced it really well. It doesn't feel like any one mode is useless, or why would I ever go into command mode when I can just, you know, defeat them on the field without ever doing that. So I never got tired of that. And it felt like a really good balance there. So I like that. I like how they kept the cast relatively small. Like you have a kind of a slew of guest characters that come through, but never more than one or two at a time. A lot of them you just don't ever get the opportunity to control directly, which I actually kind of appreciate, because sometimes it felt like even by Cold Steel 3, you get so many guest or like temporary characters that all occupied like very similar roles, and you'd have full access to their gear and their ornaments and things like that, where it's just like, I don't want to sit in a menu forever and put all the slots in place. I just want to play. So when you get introduced to some characters that have been in the a lot of the marketing for this game, you do get to control some of them, some of the fan favorites, but some of them just stay as like they'll just act on their own, which I actually, it sounds like, well, that's less control for the player, but I kind of appreciate it, because it's like you don't need to get absolute control of a cast of 30 people. And maybe it gets worse in Daybreak 2, I'm not sure, but at least for Daybreak 1, I enjoyed just they didn't go too ham on the number of characters. Maybe I just have PTSD from the Cold Steel.
I mean, we don't blame you after. Yeah.
Look, we all have PTSD from that game. Okay?
I think it's the Reverie Corridor specifically, where it's like 50 characters. Are they all geared the way you want? Do you have all the orbit slots and all the places you want? Like, I don't know. Just give me 10 characters.
Here, there's an end game in Daybreak 2 that makes the Reverie looks like a god tier game over that. That's here.
I would not go.
We'll talk about that early.
It's kind of weird, because like Chao's like doing this without having played Daybreak 2, so it's just it's just like Chao just like kind of aping on what other people are saying without seeing it.
Hey, look, I don't really care for the end game. I'm just here to write a guide and just make the game done. Okay, that's usually my.
I would say that like that's not really the case if you've played Daybreak 2 yourself instead of just
it's very different. I
wouldn't say that.
Well, we'll talk about more about Daybreak 2, of course. You guys covered that when I was out, the announcement of that, and obviously it kind of leaked just before on the PlayStation Store, and in that way, the For the story, I actually like when the story introduces kind of like a new League of Villains. I say new, but they have tiebacks in a lot of ways, kind of in that way we talked about, where if you played previous games, you'll pick up on a lot of extra stuff. But the specific villains that you encounter are kind of new, and I actually really enjoyed them quite a lot. It reminds me of Trails from Zero in that way, where the threat gets pretty major, but it's not like these villains, like I think of McBurn in Cold Steel, who is just so overpresent, and you fight him so many times that every single time he just screams louder and turns more badass, supposedly.
Can't stand Ouroboros at this point, because they don't do anything. They just come in and it's like, oh, that was just all part of the plan of beating me. You didn't stop me at all. And then they just run away and they don't do anything. But these guys are actually like unhinged. They actually like will murder people for like just for shits and giggles. And I actually like these villains for that, because they're actually menacing and dangerous.
Yeah. So these villains are called Almada. They're basically like a superpower mafia sort of thing. And their leader is very charismatic, and I love his English voice actor. I forget his name
right now. It's 9S's voice actor. It's Kyle
McCarley.
Really? Yeah. Okay, that's interesting casting.
I looked it up, and I don't recognize that name. Let's see. His name is Gerard Dantes. Let me look up his voice actor.
Like, I haven't played too much of Daybreak, but
Jason Marnaccia.
I'm thinking about Melchior.
Yeah.
Oh, Melchior, yes. He's like the, those two.
Okay, that makes sense, antagonist. Yeah.
Okay, and Melchior's pretty good. I think he's present throughout the whole game, and he kind of overstays his welcome, but he's not bad, but I really like Gerard. I don't know, he's just very charismatic, and I love his English voice, especially when you're fighting him, and they kind of modulate his voice for specific story reasons. It just works really, really well, and he hasn't really had a major villain role before, so I really liked him. And just in general,
Ben's voice actor is like incredible. Like, honestly, Damien like nailed it, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm really enjoying the cast of villains. And I really enjoy like how it introduces you to the different cities in Kalvard organically, like I said. The only thing that I didn't feel good or bad about this, but there's multiple story beats in the game where they're like, this event is just similar to what happened in Liberal 6 years ago, or what happened in Erebonia 4 years ago, or whatever. Like, there's certain events that are like, this seems familiar. And then the game's like, yeah, we know it's familiar. We're going to explicitly call it out. I'm like, oh.
That's okay. Actually one of my least favorite forms of world building, where they specifically specify exactly how long ago something was.
Like, it's like, do you remember all those details?
Like, oh, it was exactly 6 years, 7 months ago. Like, oh, wait, are we tracking this?
It's not like, it's not like that exact, but there's certain story beats, like the moment in my brain where I was like, wait a minute, this is very similar to something the game has already done. Are they just going to dip from the same, are they double dipping on just the same story theme? And then the game like doesn't hide it. They say like, oh yeah, this is similar to what we just, to something we did in a previous game. And of course, if you haven't played a previous game, you're like, oh, okay, whatever. But if you have, you're like, oh, okay, I remember that.
It does get a little bit self-serving in that respect, because I remember that, like, specifically in the English script for this game, it's like, you know, as you recall, like in the Liberal and Crosswell incidents, 5 and 7 years ago, like, you know, like the, it like it's structured like that. I'm not saying that that's exactly how it's like set verbatim, and then like the light after, it's like, as you recall, in the Erebonia Civil War 2 years ago, you know, it's very, you know, it's supposed to be a wink and nod thing, but they're very specific about it. And I do agree with Adam here that, like,
I would much rather kind of that the characters flow would speak a little bit more vaguely, like, oh, yeah, from that event several years ago, rather than, like, 3 years ago, exactly. 7 years ago, 5 years ago.
Like, they are very specific, like,
that, or like that event from this event my college years, years from my childhood, you know.
Yeah,
the fact that they put it so much on a timeline is a little bit, takes me out of it.
It's very robotic. You know, even the Japanese script is like this. So like, it's not perfect on which language you're playing this game in. It's like, it's very, but that's kind of to be expected for how Falcom does these things too. It's like, they're very formulaic, like with their dialogue, and there's no ifs or buts about it. It's like, that's the way that they do they structure their script.
And in the Cold Steel game that I played, there's a few times when the enemies are like, wow, it's been a while since we've seen each other. How long has it been? 3 months? It's like, oh, thanks for the timeline. Like, duh.
You know what I heard from a friend about the other game? What is it? Tokyo Xanadu? Do you remember the laughs? Everyone starts a sentence with ha-ha. Or what is it?
Taku.
Is it? Is that how it goes? I don't know.
The main character
that
says taku a lot, which what does that mean in Japanese? Like, sheesh? So.
It's like, yeah. Every time they always start their sentence like that. I heard some rumors that they kind of got rid of it. It's like, no, dead game now. But, you know, I'm all in for it. They had to get rid of all those ha-has. I think I found the least amount of ha-has starting a sentence in Daybreak in the English script. So I'm okay with that. I can't remember anyone starting a sentence like that.
So it's just, it sucks, but that's how they decide to do it.
And you talk about formulaic, like certain things that are well-worn in the series at this point are still present. Like, enemies will show up, they'll clearly outclass you, and they're like, well, we don't have orders to kill you, so we're just going to, pardon my language, we're just going to fuck off now, bye. So
it's like, oh no, I can't make it. It's like, I'm going to use my powers, like, and someone will come, like, no need for that technically in a different way, right?
And then there's, like, stuff like plenty of sauna scenes that have the exact dialogue you will expect out of trail sauna scenes. I'll just keep it like that. And just like, you know, it is the series that you know. So it's, if you like it or dislike it, it's not different in that way. But I will say on a more positive note, there are certain story moments that I actually really did like a lot. Like, there was one part, I'm willing to describe it very generically, between Katra and Rizet that I thought was very well done. Like, two characters that aren't the protagonist with a piece of drama that doesn't really involve the protagonist that was, I thought was pretty well done. So, like, a lot of those things that reminds me, like, why we all grew to like this series, or generally in the first place. So there are certain story moments like that I think the smaller stakes and the new cast allow you to have, rather than being like, oh, here are people that I've seen hell and back, you know, a dozen times. How much more growth can they actually undertake? It's like, oh no, these are fresh faces for the most part. We can actually kind of explore these characters a little bit more deeply, and actually, you know, show the interactions between them, like, grow and change a little bit as they just get to know each other, and as a player gets to know them too. So I really, really enjoyed it a lot. Like I said, it's in my top five for the series. I probably place it no higher than three, because I do think I like Trails from Zero and Trails Third. Like, I don't think those will ever leave the top two, but it might beat out any Cold Steel game. Cold Steel 2, I remember at the time, I liked a lot, but now I've got like three games of baggage after that that kind of like color by.
Yeah, Cold Steel 2 is definitely a time and place thing. It's like, if you're able to separate it from like a follow up games, then I think in a vacuum, Cold Steel 2.
What's the opposite of rose colored glasses? Like,
people hate that game a lot, but I actually enjoy Cold Steel 2 more than 3 and 4, to be honest with you.
But Cold Steel 2 was like the newest game, and you didn't have any foresight of like any other game after it. Like, it was a pretty cool game at the time it released.
I think the problem, there was like a long filler arc around, like, just kind of like afterward. It was just like, find this MacGuffin to fix your sword, and that was it. And that's kind of like what ruined the game. But other than that, I think the game has some very high moments.
No. Like, I always compare Cold Steel 2 to, like, if you like Super Robot Wars, you would like Cold Steel 2, because the story structure is very Super Robot Wars in that way. And I was like, okay, since I like SRW, I like Cold Steel 2. You know?
But, like, okay, so even in Daybreak, like, the main story beats are great, but, you know, the side quests are actually really solid, too. Like, I actually do enjoy the side quests in Daybreak. It has, like, a lot more, like, kind of like the mature theme telling, and, you know, I like how, like, Juan is not just there to, like, magically solve the situation. He just kind of like gives you, like, oh, here's a cop-out answer for you. You know, maybe you could do this, or maybe you could do that. It might not work, you know, but you could try that, you know. I like this approach a lot, you know. So, at least that's for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I will say is, I do agree with that. I do agree. I like the side quests, and just, like, the environment in general. One thing I didn't quite latch on to is they say, like, oh yeah, Spriggans take jobs that, like, other people wouldn't dare take on the level, or it's under the table. And there's a little bit of that, but some of the side quests are just like, these could be in any Trails game. Like,
these could be done by Bracers or the cops. Yeah, there's
a couple that are like, this could be any, but then there's a couple that do actually, like, they don't, like, it's not completely like that. There are several where it's like, oh, this doesn't have a happy ending, or this is a little bit shades of gray. So I could see that kind of fitting the theme, but then there are others, like, this could have been in any Trails game. But of course, that's, you know, at that point, it's kind of splitting hairs, and that doesn't really affect my opinion of the game at all. Because at least in the main story, like, I think the whole Vaughn's role as a Spriggan and things like that is pretty well justified and incorporated into the world building. And like, their interaction with the Bracers, like, I think the Bracers are probably more present in this game than they've been since the Sky Arc. They're very present, and it kind of feels like nostalgia in that way. Like, oh yeah, Bracers, for the best.
Yeah, so there's a lot more different factions.
I wish they could write Elvis a little bit better. He was just there just to be annoying, just to be a dick to you. Like the entire thing with him.
But yeah, in general, I feel very strongly about like just the new cast, the main cast in general that they introduced in Daybreak. I think it's they're definitely all very likable. I really appreciate how they handle like the relationship between Vaughn and Agnes in Daybreak 1. You know, it's not necessarily like it's not very corny or cheesy. It's a very it's done very at a very tasteful note. You know. I really like they. I think Agnes is such a sweetheart, and she's not like just presenting herself as like as a very like weak willed or very meek or shy. She's very expressive, and I really like. But you won't get that until like a few hours into the game. She takes some time to open up, but she's just very sweet.
I think the part that kind of totally seals that deal is like when her classmates are trying to stop her. It's like, why do you keep hanging out with that guy? It's like you should. Stay off these dangerous places. Like, it's like I have a job to do. Basically, that's kind of like the way that she expresses it. That tells you, like, kind of seals the deal with what her character role is, right?
Yeah, and then of course, go for it.
I was gonna say that I like that they don't take her too far in either direction. She's not too meek, like, oh, I'm not sure I can, and she's not too headstrong, like, I'm invincible. Like, there's just a very natural growth arc for her going from like a student that had a specific problem to like spending like a year with these troublemakers and learning a little bit more about the world at large.
So in that way, like her being like the almost like the second protagonist of the game and like being able to because Vaughn is very experienced already, like you kind of for people like understanding and learning about the world of Kalvard, like Agnes is more like the natural protagonist in which you experience the world through her eyes. And like learning about, you know, the state of the world and like these relationships through Agnes more so than Vaughn.
I think that kind of covers most of my general thoughts on Daybreak. So I'm really excited to, like, I know we got the announcement for Daybreak 2's release date, like at Anime Expo. So I'm excited for that. And then, of course, it feels strange to be like, we have that. And then we're close to being caught up. Like from official release standpoint, like a few years ago, that felt like we're 8 games behind, or now we're like 2 games behind. Like that number has continued to shrink. So I remember at the time, it feels like yesterday, but when Nisa said we're going to do the Crossbell games, and they, you know, licensed the fan translation and made edits from based on that framework, it felt like no, go into Kuro. Like no, I really do think that they made the more forward-thinking, long-term move for the series. And we're able, like, I don't know, like behind the scenes, how they're able to like keep the production like schedule moving to release these at the clip they have.
Yeah, they have a process that they finally nailed down there. It feels like at Nisa, and it's cool to see. I'm very, very interested to like know the reception of the players who experienced Daybreak too, because you know it's been kind of well established as well. It's a more divisive game, but I won't get into why, but. I'm very interested to see, like, you know, how people receive that. I have my thoughts.
And Daybreak, on it. Daybreak 1 explicitly leaves open-endedness at the end. Like, it does not wrap everything up. I'll just keep it at that. So, I don't know what happens in Daybreak
2. It doesn't wrap everything up. But if you're looking for, like, if you're the type of player, just like it's like a one and done. It's still closed off enough that like you can feel like, you know, you can still be satisfied. But like,
it'll be like the ending of Zero. Technically, it's like everything's kind of wrapped up, but. There's still some like lingering plot threads that are not solved.
It's the difference between like open endedness and a cliffhanger. It's not a cliffhanger, but there's just some open endedness to it. Like, and that's fine. I actually prefer that compared to like we're gonna wrap everything up in a nice bow, and therefore, if we want to follow up from this, we really have to like.
It's not like the finales of Trails in the Sky FC and Cold Steel 1, where like they're very big cliffhangers.
Those are like, I had to get the next game immediately. You know that?
Well, yeah, those guys cliffhangers. Like, oh fuck!
Daybreak does not end in a cliffhanger.
I'm not sure if anyone played Trails in the Sky FC when it first came out in Japan. I think it took like 3 years for SC to come out at that time. If I remember,
I think it was more than that because it didn't come out in like it came out in 2004 on PC, and then it didn't come out later until PSP in the English.
The English side's even worse because you had to wait like almost like 5 years for like the translation for it.
Yeah. So I don't know. It it seems like it was bad for both territories, so for their own different reasons. So yeah.
And in less than 60 seconds, I'm still playing through Elden Ring. I'll just say it's very different to replay through that. Like back when I played it, like I played it pre-launch for the base game, and they didn't even mark like NPCs on the map, like at all. So even having that, I'm like mind opened, you know, third eye opened or whatever. So it's very interesting to play Elden Ring again once it's kind of been like digested and distilled. And people
you
like,
played it pre-release, so you had like no context for anything anywhere that you could look off. You're just like totally blind. Into this world,
and now it's like, and now you can go to any website at all and be like, how do you do this the most optimally?
That was still like my favorite time at Elden Ring. Like, I kind of shut myself off from the world for like 3 to 4 days, and Elden Ring came out and looked up nothing, and had like, that was like, for me, that was like the most enjoyable way to play that game. It's just like, just going to it knowing nothing and just didn't look anything up. It was like just fucking taking it at your own pace and experiencing it at your own way.
So, man, I would kill to go back into the 80s to find out the Darth Vader plot twist, how people would react, and how no one is able to tell anybody about it unless they actually sell the movie. Man.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll get around to the DLC when I do. I'm in no rush, and I plan to play that DLC the same way. I still really know nothing about like the DLC in terms of like bosses already. Like I've heard like names, but I don't actually like go into streams or like look up info. Like I don't know if it's just the way I kind of consume the internet, but like I guess I'm very good at just, like, kind of like dodging spoilers or dodging like,
maybe because you never search it up, because once you like watch a random video, like a million different videos will come in related to that subject you just watched recently. That's like how the YouTube algorithm works.
I just don't care. I'm just like, I just kind of, the most I see of like videos is like kind of like promotional material, like trailers and stuff. But like, I don't really go out of my way to like go watch Let's Plays or strategy guides or content creator stuff, I guess, you know? I kind of just like still use the internet almost the same way I did like back then. I don't know if that's just a me thing of like I'm just a coffin for using the internet the way I still used to, you know. I don't know.
Well, I think FromSoft games, I think, can just kind of be not impossible, not at all, but hard to spoil just because they are a little bit more like open to interpretation. It's not as explicit in terms of like what did I witness, what happened, I need Vati Vidya to describe this to me or whatever. But also, yeah, like don't go on YouTube and say like I want to see reception to Shadow of the Erdtree, but also I don't want to be spoiled, so I'm just gonna play with fire. And then
I guess maybe I'm just crazy because like I still read text-based news and I don't go to like videos to like read the news for me and like explain it to me. I just kind of go to the source and like read, you know, what the news is instead of like going to like YouTube and having
or fossils.
I'm crazy in this. It seems like a weird thing to like say and like explain, you know. Oh, I'm so old now.
But anyways, I've eaten up enough time. But yep, that's basically what I've been up to while I've been like, I think I had a different trip. You know, I've been absent. Like I had one trip in May, one trip in June, one trip in July, but I'm back on home base for a bit, so I will be trying to catch up with Daybreak and Elden Ring and a few other things. I did also finish Saga, good game, Emerald Beyond. And then the other game that we had listed here was something that you've been playing. You said right before we started recording, you're like, I am going to play visual novels or read visual novels, and I think the game that you listed is something that is in part of that effort, but I don't know much about it. You were trying to describe it here before we started recording. It is called, I'll just tee up the name, because that's the one thing I do know for sure, Full Metal Demon Muramasa.
Yeah. So after playing and reviewing Tsukihime, I kind of miss reading visual novels. I used to like read a lot of visual novels before I joined the site, and just in general, like I remember one summer, many summers ago, before the Kickstarter of like Muv Luv, I read through the fan translation of Muv Luv Extra, Unlimited, and Alternative in one summer, and like I fell in love with that so much. I was like, "This is the greatest thing of all time."
Did you read the prequels too?
I didn't. I only made like the main trilogy at that point, that people are like, just read the main trilogy, you'll love it. It's like, yeah, but even then, like before that, you know, I read like a lot of visual novels before that. And it was just something that like every summer, I used to like read like lengthy visual novels and just like had fun with that, like, you know, like Ever 17, for example. But one visual novel that people recommended me again and again and again, and it was definitely tough to read this. This is like outside of Steins Gate, I think this is Nitro Plus's like most recognizable, or one of their most well known works outside like the Steins Gate, and I call it the semicolon series of games with like Chaos Ted, Chaos Child, and stuff like that. Full Metal Demon Muramasa came out in Japan in 2009, so it's quite old. And the official English release wasn't until 2021, and that's when, you know, but a lot of people got on board with it, because there's a very difficult visual novel even before the English. I don't know if there was like fan translations for it beforehand. I'm not sure, but this is difficult in nature to even fan translate, because of the presentation style of this game. So before I even like get into like the story and stuff like that, this is a visual novel where the dialogue box of it is not at the bottom of the screen horizontal. The dialogue box of it is primarily, in most cases, in the center of the screen vertical style. So the Japanese release of this game, the dialogue box was like, it was very, it was in the center, very slim and slender, and it was vertical text. So, you know, and as most people know, like, you know, Japanese, you can read it horizontally or you can read it vertically, and this is a very vertically based game.
In so it's like words. Written like a kind of like an oriental novel, like in Chinese novels they're read vertically from right to left,
like a scroll.
Yeah. And this is kind of, a lot of its text is like that as well. So even giving this, like, even if you're to fan translate this, you'd have to work within those restrictions, and that's extremely challenging. So like,
fan patch is like a vertical English.
I don't know if it ever got a fan translation. That's the thing. I'm not sure if it did.
Oh,
yeah. So when they finally released it in 2021, it was definitely before that. It was one of those miracle localizations of like, no one would ever thought this would get like an official English release. So what they did in the English release was like they expanded the dialogue box, so it's like they no longer have this long slender dialogue box restriction, and they were able to fit the script, the English script, within that expanded dialogue box in the center. So you can imagine that like this must have been like a nightmare to not only translate but also just typeset, and finding like, you know, working within like character limitations and restrictions, and being able to fit the script in a way so it doesn't like go outside that box or run on, and so forth. So just like thinking about the logistical like limitations and what they had to work with in this game is nothing short of a miracle. I imagine it was crazy, crazy difficult, but I'm, you know, eternally grateful, and I'm sure with other fans of this game, to be able to like give it just like an official Western release, and it reads quite well, you know, most of the time. There are like a few typos here and there, and it's also difficult in the sense that like there's a lot of like Japanese terms still like kind of like almost untranslatable because of like terms like musha, surugi. They're very explicit terms to go describe like, say, like a pilot for one of these like power suit armors that are like in this game, or surugi is like kind of like the familiars that these pilots talk to, like almost spirits that that communicate with them and also be able to like transform into their armors. So like the main character has like this armored spider as their surugi, where they can communicate with, and like that armored spider can like break apart and turn into this like power suit armor called Muramasa, so forth. So this kind of just giving background for that. The writer of this work is Itetsu Narahara. I believe this is like their most successful or well-known work as well. So I'm about like, I, I'm three chapters in. I finished chapter three not too long ago. And it's a really, really fascinating game that is, it's still very ahead of its time in terms of like how it structures and how it challenges expectations and so forth. So to set the stage, like the prologue is establishing the premise is like you're in Japan. It's sort of in this period of Japan, historical Japan, where there's like Western imperialism starting to happen in it and Western influences. But instead of like the age of the samurai, you have like these troops that can don like power suit armor instead. So instead of like the age of the samurai, it's at the age of like these musha, as they're called. And the current crisis that becomes the central crisis in this game is there is this power suit armor that flies through the air known as Ginsego or the Silver Star. And it's like this almost insect-like mecha that just totally annihilates villages that it comes across. But its presence is there. It's already too late. Because not only is this this power suit, this Ginsego armor, just extremely powerful in terms of like armaments, but like the real threat of it is like if people are within a certain vicinity of it, their mind becomes warped. They become very murderous. They become rage filled. And even like it just being within the presence of a population will annihilate it because people become murder filled and start like just killing each other left and right until nothing is left, pretty much. And any other musha that's present that can like withstand it, it's already too late for them because they're so outgunned by it. Its destructive capabilities are like just way above what any other mecha is even capable of. So just like for whatever reason, this Ginsego just annihilates villages wherever it so chooses. So that's sort of the prologue setup. So chapter one is so for people who don't want to have it spoiled, I will get into chapter one. Chapter one is it's a very big like tonal like piece of the game. Even like when you start up the game, it has the, I forgot what the name of the Yakuza font is. It's like Ito SZ or something. But it does employ the Yakuza font. So like when you boot up the game, it's like, oh, they're using the Yakuza text. They're like a dragon. And like in the caps, it's like, it is not a story of heroes. It's trying to like convey to the player, there's not a piece of work where like heroes are revered so much. So in chapter one, once again, I will spoil like, you know, elements of chapter one to kind of get the point across of what this story is. The player is introduced to these like I think they're middle school or either early high school students, like this trio of like Yuhi, Konatsu, and like Ida Yasu or something. What's his name? And the story takes place like after a great war, like a post-war sort of Japan, where this shogunate called the Rokudara has finally placed their power. So you're like within the midst of this Rokudara shogunate post-war, and you see the story in chapter one through the eyes of these three students, kind of establishing like, you know, what the state of the world is at this point, and like they're like just part of this this town, going to classes and learning about like, you know, just a lot of like in world terms of like, what are the musha? What are dragoons? And there's like very distinct terms between like mass production mecha and ones that are very special musha that can don like original armors that have been forged by like these ancient weaponsmiths in the past. And so like they're like, so instead of like being mass military grade, these are like the original armors that like have very, very special properties to them, and have like very, and are few and far in between and so forth. So and the story in chapter one is ostensibly One of the students is missing, and that student is like a close friend of this trio of students. As you're investigating, you know, the disappearance of your friend through these middle school students, you eventually come upon like this police officer. His name is Minato Kageyaki, who assists you in there. Like he's also looking into these disappearances of like these townsfolk in town. But you know, eventually you're able to cooperate with him on like, hey, help us out and like trying to find our missing friend, and so forth. And so you're kind of put into like this very simple but straightforward story about this mystery of disappearances, and that all leads up to near the end of the chapter, where you find out that like, hey, your teacher is the one who's behind these disappearances. They're kind of fucked in the head, because they're like a serial murderer, and so you find like the corpse of like your friend in the box, all chopped up, and these three middle school students who are, you know, that you enlist the aid of your teacher, but you only find out after the fact that he's the serial murderer, like in this very isolated site. So it's kind of already too late for these three students to like have a chance, because this their teacher, who they just found out is a serial murderer, is also a Musha. So like he dons the power armor, and really, really graphic fucked up shit happens, let's say, at the end of this, to really drive home the point of like how violent some of these Musha people pilots are, and how, what their capabilities are. You know, after once they don the armor, like no ordinary human has a chance against them. Pretty much. So Konatsu and Idayasu, like the two friends from Yuhi, let's say they get fucked up. They're not outright killed, but they get really fucked up, and pretty much cannot function as ordinary people. Like one of them gets their eyes kind of slashed, so they're permanently blind, and the other has a worse fate than that. But Yuhi, you know, has a hole in his foot, as a consequence of being able to, like, you know, stand up to, like, this person. They kind of get toyed with, but, you know, don't really stand much of a chance, obviously, against this Musha murderer. Just as that they're about to get killed, Minato shows up, like the police officer shows up, and also reveals that he is also a Musha pilot of the Spunamasa power armor, which is kind of central, obviously, the title character of this work, pretty much. So Minato is actually the protagonist of this work, so it kind of switches perspectives from this point on. But to close out chapter one, it does a really, really cool perspective shift of, like, it doesn't go to Minato's perspective from Yuhi, because up until this point, you only had the perspective of, like, these three students. It actually switches to, like, their teacher's perspective in the battle, this initial battle against Muramasa. So you have this, like, power armor fight in the air against Muramasa, and now the text is from the perspective of this teacher. And it does this because while the teacher is very good at, like, murdering civilians, it's not so good at, like, against fighting other Musha pilots. They're very green at that, and that's what establishes the fundamentals of Musha combat, of free flight combat, what 3D maneuvering in the air is. And it goes very into detail of, like common strategies and approaches of, like, the fundamentals of Musha combat. And it's established through, like, the green eyes of, like, someone very inexperienced. They're not used to that, and so forth. So a lot of text goes by of, like, establishing the fundamentals of combat in that respect. So
these combat scenes sound very intense. I just wonder, like, how is it, like visually for this kind of visual novel kind of thing? It's kind of hard to imagine.
Yeah, I mean, like, since the text is on in the center of the screen, you get to see, like, full, almost full body portraits of these characters interacting with one another, and since it's like, since that text is placed in the center of them, it's, it kind of flows naturally as like, as an exchange from back and forth between these two characters, and like you're kind of that text is embodied at the center of it, of their interaction. So, and the cool perspective thing about this one is like, when it switches perspective to this to their teacher, you kind of get like an inside view, not necessarily a cockpit view, because you're not necessarily a pilot in this big mecha, but you do get like this like kind of interface screen with a lot of like on-screen data, like, you know, it's meant to emulate like some sort of like pilot vision on this, and it's kind of like Mublov in that aspect, where like to signify action, you do get a lot of like sound effects, engine effects, or sound effects, and like and a lot of movement of like the artwork of like when they're like zooming to each other, sort of like how the mechs are in Mublov, and to simulate, you know, that there's ongoing action and motion on the screen. It does that sort of that, and sometimes like for this introductory chapter, it'll go to like small video clips of like, since it's like a 2009, like the CGI was relatively, you know, still not as great as it is today, but it does have like sort of like motion video with CGI of like movement, and so forth. So, and it's only really a present for this like introductory chapter. So you kind of get into this whole battle in which, like, you know, you learn about Minato and Muramasa's mission to gather Ginsego's eggs before they hatch, and you know it's revealed in other chapters why they're trying to prevent these eggs from hatching. But for the purposes of this introductory chapter, you learn that Ginsego's eggs are implanted in like several Musha throughout the region, and one of the eggs was implanted in the power armor of this teacher, and so forth. So they're trying to collect those for their mission, and so Muramasa eventually takes down and kills the teacher, you know, for their crimes, but not necessarily punishing for their crimes. They just want the egg, but you know, but also they retrieve the egg, and in order to retrieve the egg, they kind of need to kill the power armor for that, and thus its pilot as well. So it's like, oh wow, there's like this really cool hero who's like has this virtuous mission to kind of punish evildoers and so forth. That's what you think, and then like before the chapter one ends, you see Muramasa one more time visiting Yuhi. His two friends are off in intensive care at the hospital, and he's like, he got off, like, you know, his foot is still not in a great state, but it's like, he's faring well, better than his friends. So you're like, oh, why is Muramasa like visiting this kid? It's like just like, you know, exchanging words or something. But it does give Yuhi a chance to offer like, you know, thanks of what he did of rescuing them. This very, for many players of this for this game, there's like one of the most iconic scenes in the game. This is chapter one ending, where the shot composition is their shadows. You see the shadow of Muramasa and this kid looking at each other, you know, and then all of a sudden Muramasa doesn't say anything about you. He's giving his thanks, and before the scene ends, you see within those silhouettes, those shadows, of a blade flash, and you see that kid's head get sliced off, and you're like, what the fuck is going on? Why did Muramasa just kill this kid, you know? And right before chapter one ends, you see Minato going to the commissioner, and the commissioner saying, hey, you're under arrest for killing this teacher and this kid. And then that's where the chapter ends. And you find out later that, for once again, this is not a story about heroes, and Minato is an established murderer, and a sort of as a trade-off for the curse of Muramasa of donning this power armor. I'm not sure if this is exactly what it's going to be, like the explanation, but what I suspect is that there has to be a balance. And whenever you boot up this game, it says like in between like the two screens, good and evil, the law of balance, before you get to the title screen. I imagine for every life that you take with Muramasa, the like an evildoer, there has to be a balance. You have to take the life of another that's considered good. So in order to offset the life that you took of the evildoer, you have to take the life of someone who's relevant and that's considered good. So, you know, there's only really one person that you can slay. That was, like, you know, part of that incident. That was, unfortunately, that kid. Because the other two, they're quote-unquote alive, but not really in a great state. And you're just like, and you have that shock factor from that first chapter. You know, you'll get a better idea of, like, what Binado's mission, overall mission is, and why he's doing this and introducing other characters along the way. But it's just like that, you have a very shocking first chapter of, like, oh wow, the protagonist of this work is actually this dude, and he's, you know, murdering not only evildoers but also murdering kids as well, which is, yeah, not great, not great, but you know, you kind of get an explanation of why he does that, as sort of like to counteract the curse of Muramasa on that end. So it's a really, really fascinating opening chapter. It is a really fascinating visual novel overall, of like the way it kind of presents itself. Like, one of the things that you can pull up in the game is like these affection meters, and like you'll see affection meters for like these two ladies that you're become introduced to at the first chapter, but you don't really know how you sort of get to know them. So like, obviously their affection meters are like empty at that point. And there's like two other affection meters. One is completely blacked out and like inaccessible, and then another one that's like you just don't know what it is yet. You'll get to understand what this affection meter means over time. And I think what you think this affection meter is probably not what it's going to be. It's really, really interesting how they implement this affection meter in the game. And it's just a really, really, I can understand why people have so much praise for this visual novel. This early on at chapter 4, like I say early on, but I've probably like read maybe 15 to 20 hours of this visual novel at this point, and I've chapter
so 4. Wait, just like 20 hours is for that long?
I'm at chapter 4 now, and it's like maybe 20 hours in, maybe 15 to 20 hours in. I didn't actually check my hour count yet, but these are pretty lengthy chapters and pretty substantial, because each of the chapters so far are held at another like case of like, hey, we've detected the location of a Ginsego's egg here, go find out what's going on. And each of these chapters are like at different locales, so you have to go find out like what's going on there and the location of Ginsego's egg, and then accumulate, like, you know, build up to like this battle to go get that egg pretty much, and so forth. So it's a really, really great visual novel so far that I've been having a lot of fun reading and like learning about these characters. But it's very, very gruesome and violent in some aspects. Not always gruesome and violent, but when it does it, it's there to make a point of it. So it doesn't indulge in it, but it is there. It is very present. So I think it's just a really, really interesting work so far. And I really love the main characters, like, the main character like transforms into Muramasa, like he has like this chant, or like this he has to like recite these lines to go into
main
it. And like the intro of it is, where there are demons, I slay them, where there are saints, I slay them. And it's like, oh, that's fucking badass. So
I don't know, like old school anime. I think of like Samurai Keeper Kyo, whatever. Every time he like unsheathed the sword, it takes fucking forever, but it looks so badass, you know?
Yeah. I know it's been quite a while for me to get around to reading this, but I figured this, you know, kind of an opportune time. Like, I'm in the mood to read visual novels. So I was like, I should probably go read this. It was on sale, and I was like, I picked it up. I fully intend to, you know, 100% I'm fascinated by
it. Which version did you pick up? Is it the
I got from Jast USA, so okay. Yeah, but I know it's on GOG as well. I imagine for the GOG version you have to like apply a patch to it to kind of unlock the full game.
That's pretty gruesome already. There are
definitely adult scenes in it. It doesn't hold back. But you know, I think it's wild. It's a very, very wild read so far, and I'm looking forward to just like reading more of it. So I should probably be like, you know, playing an RPG, but I'm just like, look, man, I got to return to the old me sometime. And I just love once you start reading like a good visual novel, it's hard to like stop until you're done with it. It just kind of gets into it, hits hooks into
you. Yeah, well, when you're in a phase to play it, you just can't stop playing it.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm having a blast. So that's Full Metal Demon Muramasa. I don't know if I'll have it done by this time next week, or maybe it'll last longer than that. I don't know.
Wow, you make me interested in checking it out.
Yeah, it's definitely. If you're okay with reading these types of stories, definitely do. I think that's something. You know, I don't care if a game has nudity or anything or sex scenes or anything like that. That's usually not like.
Look, not Game of Thrones was the most popular show for one point of time.
Like for me, those aren't really reasons to like stay away from a game personally. For like if they're done in a way that's like they're there for a point, pretty much, you know.
That whole thing used to be considered taboo for TV at one point until they saw the ratings.
Yeah. So yeah, and this probably won't be the last visual novel I read this year if I get around to Fate Stay Night and reread that, you know, see what the official English script is like, you know. And fuck, man, Fate Stay Night is a long-ass read, too. A really long read. So, yeah, that's Full Metal Demon Muramasa.
I think some of our most interesting conversations are when we're not stuck playing just RPGs that came out in the last week. Like, it's good to revisit games that are either older or out of the other genre, or we're revisiting a game we've already played in some cases. Like, those things are very perfectly allowed, and I encourage it.
Once I'm done Daybreak, I'm going to beat Onimusha 2 again. Just for the hell of it.
Hell yeah.
I've been watching in Discord chat, Adam's been playing through Kingdom Hearts on Steam, which of course is kind of vogue because it's just a recent release of an older game, but kind of, you know, nostalgic to revisit those. And be like, man, Chain of Memories is so jank. But yeah.
But it's not even the original Chain of Memories too. It's the like they polished it up and changed it up to make it more palatable, unlike the people who played on Game Boy Advance. Like, we fucking love cards.
I've only been the PS2 version. I have never played the Game Boy version.
I played the Game Boy Advance version. I'll never forget it because it was actually like a birthday present for my sister. A silver GBA SP and Chain of Memories.
These are relics. Do you still have it?
I still have it.
Those original Chain of Memories days were kind of weird because that was before like Kingdom Hearts was like a franchise. There was like the one game which had an open-ended ending, but it wasn't like a cliffhanger, I guess, sort of. And then like Chain of Memories comes out and it's sort of like way different than anything else. This white castle. Who are these guys in black cloaks? Where did they come from? There's this guy named Axel. He said hell. I remember that was a big thing. Axel said hell.
Oh my
in
God,
a Disney game.
Look. I imported Final Mix 2 and I was like playing it. I'm like, who the hell is this kid? And what the hell is going on in the story?
Oh,
and
I remember that. Before we had a name on all the forums, he was blonde haired kid.
Yeah.
Who's that blonde haired kid? BHK at the end of, anyways, sorry for this tangent, but Adam's been playing through those and I've just been thinking about playing older games and games that I would also like to return
So like it was when Kingdom Hearts 2 was announced and they basically immediately were like, yeah, you have to play Chain of Memories to go into this. I mean, you don't have to, but like it takes place directly after that or you're going to be a little bit confused. I don't know, like imagine if they made a sequel to like Final Fantasy 12 and we were like, but you have to play the DS game to understand what's going on.
Revenant Wings.
Yeah, you have to remember that. What the I don't remember anything about it.
with the winged people or the white Fiera. I don't remember.
Yeah,
any of that. I vaguely remember it. Yeah. Anyways, well, with that, I think we'll go into headlines and news. The first thing we have here, we talked about a handful of these already in passing. They're like we stated a while back. James has been busy at Anime Expo and also writing up all of his thoughts and opportunities up on the site. So you've gotten a lot of written features. You have an interview with Spike Chunsoft. You've got the CyberConnect 2. You're able to talk to the Fugo producers again, Karin Ciel. And then this is not directly related to Anime Expo, but we did talk about Dawn Trail, I think 2 weeks ago when it first launched, and you and Chow were still making your way through it. And you wrote up an impressions piece on that as well. Did you want us? Like, is there anything here that you didn't cover already when talking about Anime Expo, or anything here you wanted to go deeper into before we go into the headlines?
Nah, nothing specific. Like, if that, because, like, yeah, I basically talked about everything I want to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, but I just want to at least give a shout out that James does have a lot of features up on the site. If you go to rpgsite.net and you hit either the articles tab, that should be able to find all the long form things that James has written up over the last couple weeks. With his opportunities at Anime Expo and his time with Dawn Trail. So with that, we'll go into news this week. So again, thank you to Adam, Josh, and others for covering the news while I was out. So I did not team myself up for a lot of these news bits, admittedly, so please catch me where I falter. But this one I did read because the writing was kind of on the wall, and it's when I saw this headline, I was disappointed but not surprised. And that is that Piranha Bytes under Embracer, the developers behind Gothic, Risen, and Elex, is now closed. So there was some rumblings of this potentially earlier in the year. We had an article back in January that they were either going to be closed or sold if possible. They came to their socials and said, nope, we're still planning to be around as long as we can. Unfortunately, that was wishful thinking, and Piranha Bytes is gone. And I know I did not grow up with Gothic. I only played Elex, but I know a lot of people who feel very strongly about the Gothic series and about Piranha Bytes in general. And it's just sad to see a developer that has been in the game for decades just no longer cease to be in the, you know, as a casualty of corporate consolidation. And it's the trend we've been seeing for the last 2 years. It's nothing new. And that's what kind of makes it suck even more is that we're becoming numb to it, even though we try not to be. It's like, oh, look, another studio is gone. Like we just talked about Tango and about Arcane Austin and the dozens of others that I'm just slipping because it's been such a frequent occurrence. Just another one to add to the list, unfortunately. Yeah. And a little bit of positive news. I was just going to talk about their indie studio that they're going to try to get off the ground. So immediately in the same breath of Piranha Bytes being closed down, some of the executives or former executives of Piranha Bytes are forming an indie studio called Pithead Studio that they are planning to develop new fantastic and immersive games. Of course, this is just good to see, just to know that they are passionate about what they do. Just because Piranha Bytes is closed, they want to continue doing what they love. And they are going to do that however they can under the new name, Pithead Studio. So hopefully that venture is successful for them, and obviously are excited to see if they're going to try to persevere in whatever way they can.
And I know there's always something that people will ask about, so we want to reiterate again that Piranha Bytes was not involved in the remake of Gothic. It's still being currently developed by Alchemia Interactive. Which is being published by THQ Nordic. So, yeah, even though Piranha Bytes is closed, that remake of Gothic that people have, you know, a lot of eyes are on it, that's still being developed.
Because it's kind of a weird thing where it's like it's someone else's. It's Gothic is basically Piranha Bytes' debut game, I believe, and well liked, and this is being developed by someone else, but it's still under Embracer. It's a little strange.
Yeah.
And actually, on that note, THQ Nordic, which again is under Embracer, does have an event in August where they're going to show off a few things, including that. So, that's coming.
The next two headlines are about games coming to the PlayStation Plus catalog. And Josh, you covered these, and I'll just go ahead and let you take the headline on these two games coming July 16th, mainly because, I'll be honest here, I don't know how PlayStation Plus Premium or Game Catalog works because I don't have it.
Yeah, so I actually did. So people who are confused, I actually detailed this in the in one of these headlines. So first off, Sony unveiled the next batch of games coming to the Game Catalog for PlayStation Plus Extra and the Premium tiers. So every month, if you're paying for Premium and the Extra tiers for PlayStation Plus, you do get access to, you know, some more games for quote unquote free because you're paying for those tiers. So for this month, like for more modern releases, you have like Remnant 2 and Crisis Core Reunion and Mountain Blade 2 coming to it, along with Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous, No More Heroes 3, and so forth. So that's actually a pretty damn RPG packed month.
Those are some pretty good titles.
Yeah, coming to it. So, and along with that, the Sony uses this as a way to add new PlayStation legacy titles to PSN Store, and those are playable through PS4 and PS5 devices. And
so, just to give people a heads up, because this is how it's worked in the past.
Yeah.
Even though you cannot directly buy these games on the PlayStation 4 or PlayStation 5 PSN, if you have a PS3 or a Vita hooked up, and like you can connect to their PSNs, you can buy these games, and then you won't have to sub to like these services, these extra services, in order to play them on PS4 or PS5.
Wait, I'm a little confused.
I was about to mention this. So you are right, James, but also you can do this through their PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5. I gave this example with Daxter on the Jean d'Arc article, where Daxter was announced in the PlayStation Plus Game Catalog update in June, and it received its own separate PlayStation Store page for people who want just to purchase Daxter alone and just the game itself without being subbed to PlayStation Plus.
Okay.
That
wasn't something they originally had. So I guess they decided to make it less cumbersome if you wanted to.
So like with Daxter, you can go access it on PlayStation Store right now and just buy it for $9.99 completely separately on its own. You do not have to sub through PlayStation Plus Premium or any of its other tiers to play that game. So coming this month, on July 16th, to PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5, both Jean d'Arc and Summoner are coming to the service. Obviously, the one that a lot of our audience is really, really excited for is Jean d'Arc, because that was previously released on PlayStation Portable in 2007 in the West.
Only in North America.
Yeah, only in North America, which is, and obviously in Japan as well. But it never got a European release. So this is interesting because this will be the first time Europe officially receives Jean d'Arc over there since original release in the West in 2007.
Is this like the first kind of like PSP port on like modern consoles?
So this was developed by Level 5, and it did get a PSN Store release for PS3 and Vita, but it didn't have like, but it was a straight port of that. It didn't have like any enhancements to it. While this new upcoming release for it will have some of the base enhancements that's coming to these modern legacy titles coming to PlayStation Store. So stuff like up rendering, rewind, quick save, and custom video filters, those will be integrated into this upcoming release of Jean d'Arc, because that's what their internal emulator is can do for these PlayStation legacy titles not coming to PSN Store. Once again, I know this got really, really confusing because, you know, I understand where James is coming from, but he kind of muddied up, you know, the message. Once again, you can completely separately purchase these without a PlayStation Plus Extra or Premium subscription. Once it goes up on July 16th, you can purchase both Jean d'Arc and Summoner completely separately for $9.99 USD. I don't know how it's priced in Europe, but I assume it's going to be around that price range. as well. You do not have to subscribe to PlayStation Plus at all to access and play these games. Yeah. So
in that I know same about breath, a year like, and a half ago, they released... They're not PSP games. So I didn't know if that made a difference. But about a year and a half ago, they released Wild Arms 2 and Legend of Dragoon onto their, like... It was similar in that they were, like, part of the PS Plus catalog. But you can just buy those.
Yeah.
In fact, it was a small wrinkle. Since I already owned Wild Arms 2 digital version on, like, PS3... My Sony account like flags that, and actually you can just download the PS4 or 5 version for free. I don't think that's the case here. Maybe it is, but
I'm not sure if that happens
sometimes.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure if this is still the case here, but so if you previously bought John the Ark on PS3 and Vita, like when it went up on the store that way, go check it out on July 16th.
Yeah, you might get it for free if they do it similarly.
Yeah. The reason I even brought that up is that is how it has been in the past. Mm-hmm. It is just up to whether or not they surface the ability to buy directly on PS4 and PS5, because there have been cases where they haven't had that option. But as far as I understand it, everything that's available through the service, like these higher PlayStation Plus tiers for like retro games, if you own them already, you can play them without the PlayStation Plus. It's just up in the air whether or not you'll be able to just buy them when they're up on the store. I imagine you're right that that they will be available for you to buy, but I'm just saying it doesn't hurt to just buy it now on Vita because you will have it either way.
If people still have access to that, it's not, those aren't easily accessible.
Yeah,
these days. But like I said, they've done this very recently with stuff like Daxter, so. It's reason, you know, I don't imagine they're going to suddenly, this will be the turning point, like, oh, we won't do it.
Yeah.
Because you know, they've done this for other PSP legacy titles recently. So, I also, like I mentioned, Summoner, the PS2 launch title, will also be joining this as well on PS5 and PS4 on July 16th. So unfortunately, I didn't want to dig this back up, but this was developed by Volition, which has now since closed down, and was published by original THQ before they muddied the waters of what THQ is now. This is an interesting release because this was actually ported to PC in 2001. It's still available to purchase on Steam to this day, but its sequel, Summoner 2, did not get a PC release. And has not since, so that's only accessible on PS2 and GameCube still. So, yeah, that's just kind of the heads up. Hey, if you want to do, for some reason, you know, play Summoner on PS5 and PS4, that's coming soon as well.
Thank you for detailing exactly how those work, because, you know, Nintendo Switch Online works differently, and of course, Game Pass, that was in the news this week too, about price increases and the flow chart for making sense of all that. They all work slightly differently. And I used to have PlayStation Plus in the PS3 era, but not since they've reshaped how the deluxe and premium work and all that. So
when they did the first real price increase from 60 to 70, I was like, I'm never buying this again. And then they did another price increase shortly after. And it's like, yeah, sure as hell. Never getting seen me do that. I don't even play multiplayer games on PS5. Why would I?
In a similar vein of another game that's being made available on modern platforms, Way Forward is bringing the Game Boy Advance game Sigma Star Saga to PC and modern consoles in 2025. Did anyone play the Sigma Star Saga?
I did not.
I've even heard of them.
Yeah, there's a first time hearing about it, unfortunately. I don't know much about it. There's an interesting one, too, because the Way Forward is also going to be releasing this on repro cards that are Game Boy Advance compatible. So they are also re-releasing this game on Game Boy Advance.
It's like a reprint in a way.
Yeah. So they haven't mentioned exactly which modern consoles is coming to, but they did also mention it's also coming to PC. I think it's just really fucking cool. This is also interesting because this next year is going to be the 20-year anniversary of Sigma Star Saga, and they did develop that game. They were the original developers for that Game Boy Advance release as well, way back then. They're working with Bandai Namco Games, so to, you know, because of the licensing of it, it is with Bandai Namco, so they are working with Bandai Namco to release this, and will be utilizing the Carbon Engine from Limited Run Games for this release. So, from what I understand of this game, it is part side-scroller shmup that you can customize your ship. Along with, there's like some on-foot like field exploration in it as well. So similar to Blaster Master from the footage I saw. But other than that, I don't really know too much about this game, unfortunately. But for the few people I've seen who have played it, they've had nothing but good things to say about it. Played the original game.
We do have a couple more announcements here before we go into a small number of updates and release dates. We have an announcement of a new debut title for developer Mistold Games being published by Whisper Games. This is a tactical RPG. The name of the title is Parasite Duality Unbound. I know that's a bit of a mouthful. I'll say it again. Parasite Duality Unbound. So we have an announcement trailer for this game. And after watching the trailer, the easiest way I can describe it, is, and based also on the press release that we have up on the site, is that it's an isometric tactical RPG. However, based on the Duality Unbound, you can toggle between two different versions of your combat field with your squad. And that's kind of the hook or the gimmick of the game, is that there's two parallel realities that you can interface with at the same time that you toggle between. And I think there are other games that do something similar, but nothing's coming directly to mind. But this is slated to announce for basically all modern platforms and PC next year. And the announcement trailer seems interesting enough and has a decent amount of gameplay examples showing the art and the characters and what the gameplay looks like with the phase toggling mechanic of that. So pretty neat title here.
Yeah, and then they also mentioned there'll be like some base management and some open field exploration outside of battle that you can tinker with as well. I'm kind of interested to see, like, you know, what the player interface and just like what normal gameplay looks like. It is a pretty interesting title, and like you mentioned, this is the debut title from Mistold Games, who are based both in the US and China. So yeah, cool to see, you know, Whisper Games, who previously published Excalibra. You know, they're continuing to, you know, ride that momentum and publish, you know, cool new indie titles as well. Good on them.
And the way they describe this is that they say the game is two-sided. There's like two sides of every battlefield that you can toggle between.
Yeah.
So. And then one other thing that Kite covered for us, coming out of publisher Compile Heart and Sting, is that there is going to be a new Sorcery Saga game coming out on PlayStation and Switch late in the year, in late November, in Japan.
I forgot they actually localized a Mado Monogatari game in the West as Sorcery Saga. Now, when I looked at it, I was like, oh yeah, I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, it's like, it took me a moment to realize, it's like, wait a second, oh, that makes sense, because yeah, that is a translation of Mado Monogatari.
It definitely scrambled my brain for a bit, so good on Kite for remembering, because I totally forgot. we've mentioned this when Compile Heart detailed their roadmap of like all their upcoming projects. So they provided some updates on that. Unfortunately, the stuff like one of the, like two of their titles, the shmup and like the delivery service RPG, got a major delay from like this summer in Japan to next summer now in Japan. So those both got major delays. But they also unveiled like the first detail of Mado Monogatari 4, which is the first numbered Mado Monogatari in a very, very long time, since 1990. Not to say that there were other Mado Monogatari games that came out since then, but this one, its official title in Japan is Mado Monogatari Fia to Fushigi na Gakko, which is Kite's translation of it is Sorcery Saga Fia and the Mysterious School. So they provided first details on that. It's no longer a first-person dungeon RPG. It seems to be like an isometric dungeon exploring RPG. So, you know, a lot of people who are into Modern Monogatari will see a lot of familiar like enemy designs, monster designs coming out of it. Of course, the Puyo Puyo community should recognize a lot of the designs because the Modern Monogatari series was like the root series that Puyo Puyo spun out of, interestingly enough. So yeah, there's
yeah, if you look closely, you'll notice in some of the artwork that they've shared, you can even see Carbuncle and even some Puyos.
Yeah. So yeah, Kai gave a great like in-depth write-up of like, you know, all the first details that they shared coming for this. You know, I imagine they'll announce a Western localization soon, hopefully, you know, because they did bring a prior entry as Sorcery Sagra to the West previously. So yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot of I do know the Modo Monogatari series, but I never really played much of them.
If Idea Factory doesn't bring it over, I'm sure like Axis will.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure that Idea Factory will. They don't have that many ever games they can, and this seems like a home run where it's like you can just market it as, hey, this is like tangentially related to Puyo.
So yeah, so and then Kite did mention the primary character designer on this new entry is Sunaho Kobe, but the other contributing character designers are Shinichiro Otsuka, Ichi, and of course people should know this one, Katsumi Inami, also contributing character designs to this new entry in the Mado Monogatari series.
And also to Kaino Kaseki.
Or the new Star Ocean.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't do the Star Ocean anymore, right? It's...
No, but he did the remake.
The remake. He did the first. Okay.
The first departure remake.
What's the name of this guy who did like Divine Force?
Characters? I don't remember.
Akiman?
Yeah.
Akiman.
Inami did a few. I probably have said this on the podcast before, but like I didn't realize he did like the designs for like Star Ocean 4 because in the West we didn't get that art. We got the CG models originally.
Yeah.
So
and then it was until the international that we got the toggle.
I was like, oh wow, this the 2D art is way better.
Who would have thought? That's funny.
We have one update for a game that kind of came out earlier this year and was unfortunately a little out of the radar just because February and March were insane. But Syrian the Wanderer, the Mystery Dungeon of Serpentcoil Island, did get a free update back in early July. With the main inclusion here is the addition of Tatsumi Shirin, which is a combination of Shirin and Tatsumi. I've not played the original game, so I don't know what that means, but the artwork is very neat.
Yeah, this was kind of expected because, like, one of the things with, I guess, Shirin has a plot. It doesn't really matter. It's kind of like East in that sense. But the core of the kind of plot for this most recent Shirin was there's, like, the rain god and the sun god. And basically, in the base game, you were able to kind of fuse with the sun god for a dungeon, and it would have unique gameplay for it. And then the question was kind of up in the air when they announced they were going to have additional posts like launch like updates, if there would be a dungeon where you could do the opposite. And that's what they've shown. So.
Cool.
James, how do you feel about almost every dungeon in the game having a new dungeon limit cap of 99? So now like almost every dungeon has like 99 floors.
Oh, is that like a new post-game thing where it's like it adds that option, or is it something?
So they said like in Sacred Tree mode, the following dungeons will have more floors, offering a greater challenge and more opportunities for exploration. So a bunch of these have like a new, like Kiki Island, for example, it used to be 25 floors. Now you can go up to 99 floors in Kiki Island.
Okay, so here's the thing. You'll even notice it says that you can only select that for dungeons you've already cleared. The first time you clear it, it'll always be. I think that's fine. I think like, the game wasn't really suffering from content in the first place. I feel like it had like plenty enough where it was like very easy to recommend. I gave it a 9. I'd say that this is still one of my favorite games of like 2024. Having the ability to like tackle harder challenges as an optional like toggle once you've cleared a dungeon for the first time is neat. I think that is really cool. I think.
It's just basically like a endless dungeon mode, pretty much. It's like, hey, you can't get enough sheer in? Check this shit out.
I think I saw something over the last week that Shiren the Wanderer in Japan is still like a top 10 selling game of the year.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Oh yeah, it like blew up in Japan. It did really well, which is why I even remember like podcast earlier this year, I mentioned that and I was like, this is great because it means that we will definitely get a Shiren 7 and it won't be as long of a wait as the gap between Shiren 5 and 6, which was over a decade. Now just port it to PC.
To get back to, just because it could kind of go under the radar this year, but it seems like it's definitely would be up my alley. But it would also be the first Mystery Dungeon type game for me.
I'm curious, can you even still get like physical copies of this? Because I part of the reason I got one was because I figured it would be one of those games that would eventually be hard to pick up. Now you can still get it. It's still full price though, so that tells me that probably pretty soon it's going to be really hard to find these if it's still like not quite full price, but it's like around there and it's like 6 months later. This might be hard to find in the next couple of months. What about Best Buy? That was just Amazon.
Just put it on Steam.
I also forgot this was Switch exclusive, so it'll go on Steam probably. Who knows?
Yeah. So like full price it. Still full price at Best Buy.
I'll pick it up at full price on Steam.
Yep. This doesn't seem like it's selling too hot physically, because like there's only like 36 reviews for it on Amazon. And it's only like 50 people bought it in the past month, which that's, hopefully it's been doing all right for Spike Chunsoft overall.
We can champion for it here.
Yeah.
Should have told them Anime Expo to release it on Steam right now.
And with that, we're nearing the end of our slate of headlines here. We have just a few dates here. We have a new entry in the Dark Universe from White Wolf. We have Werewolf the Apocalypse Purgatory is a narrative RPG that'll be releasing on PC and other consoles in late July on the 23rd. There is a whole lot of these in the White Wolf, discography.
Yeah, there's a bunch of these little indie...
Vampire the Masquerade,
visual novels, or point and clicks, adventure games. There's a bunch.
Yeah, so not sure how the reception on those seems to be hit or miss, but we're getting one, and specifically Werewolf the Apocalypse. I don't think that has existed before.
No, this studio actually had another one earlier.
Oh, really? Yeah. I do remember the Vampire the Masquerade one and a few of the others, but not Werewolf. But okay, Werewolf the Apocalypse Purgatory coming out on. July 23rd.
What was the one minorly amusing thing about this is when they originally announced it, they announced it just for PC. And this was like a month ago, not that long ago. And then when they announced the release date, they're like, actually, it's coming to all consoles also, as well as iOS. It's like, oh, okay. That's cool.
Neat.
More platforms is good.
In early August, we have a release date for a game that we talked about during the Steam Indie Fest, and that is Deathbound. This is one of the Souls likes that I tried to describe a few weeks ago to try to keep them all separate.
It the way one of the emails did, which I kind of scoffed at because it's funny. It's like we have the combat of Dark Souls in a party like Baldur's Gate 3 or something like that.
Please buy our game.
What does that mean?
Basically, what the gimmick is it's a Souls-ish game, but you can switch between characters. Like, you don't really have a party. You just have four different forms.
You share the same vessel, right?
Yeah, right? That they call it a party. But I saw that one of the PR emails trying to describe it as a mix of Souls and Baldur's Gate 3 is just kind of like.
It's always kind of funny when PR has to spice up.
They have to try to list it, compare it to something popular. So.
Right.
Oh, and they call it morphing when you change styles, which I think is just, we should use the word morph more often. I don't know. I forget if you were on that podcast, Adam, but we had a bunch of these announced in a row. And I do remember this one, trying to separate them all. What's the gimmick here? What's the gimmick here? How's this one? So yeah, this is the one where you morph between different forms. And a Souls coming out on August 8th, and it'll be available on Xbox, PlayStation 5, and PC.
If I was like a PR person writing up this script, I'd be like super obnoxious. Like, imagine an Elden Ring like world exploration with what's another popular with Fortnite like shooting systems and Call of Duty progression, and people are like, what the fuck do you mean? It's like, shut up.
Well, that does remind me, random tangent. I did see, I think, 3 costumes at Fan Expo of Hornet from the Hollow Knight follow-up.
Silksong?
People are excited. Yeah,
Silksong. Yeah, Silksong.
So there were 3 Hornets at least.
Oh, congratulations. I mean, congrats on
I was thinking of that because like,
I never thought that we like there'd be like Silksong cosplay already. I thought people would just like wait till like the game released and
Keep
Deathly Universe.
I mean, the main character of Silksong was already a character in the original, so
that's true. Yeah.
That is true.
Why I was thinking of that because I was imagining like we've got the combat of a Souls, like we've got a party of Baldur's Gate, we've got the atmosphere of a Hollow Knight, we've got a exploration like a Metroidvania, and it's like how many buzzwords can we throw?
They're so mean, actually. Fuck.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not sorry.
Hollow Knight Silksong fans, or just Hollow Knight fans in general, if you really can't wait until Silksong, have you considered Nine Souls? Yeah, I mean, that's very much a Hollow Knight adjacent Metroidvania that is very good. Just today, it hit overwhelmingly positive on Steam. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Nice, yeah. Congrats. But you have to describe it to people with, like, you know, with
Metroid instead of insect
exploration.
Yeah.
And, yep.
The last two headlines are actually on the same date. We've talked about both of these in the past. Greedfall 2, The Dying World. Adam was able to preview this for us a little bit about a month ago, a few weeks back. It will be entering Steam Early Access on September 24th.
Yeah.
And then also entering... Oh, go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, I was just saying they just detailed that like the unlaunch, the Early Access launch, you know, you'll be able to play like the first chapters, the main quests, and then have like 3 explorable regions on there, but they also noted like throughout the early access period they'll add new companions, quests, zones, skills, etc. But once again, this is the Steam early access date, still on track for a 2025 full release on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series, and PC.
I did see the headline from Nason, who is the publisher. They just call this the release date announcement.
Yeah,
and yes, I don't know how I feel about that.
It's deceptive almost. I don't know if it's like, deceptive, but it's very misleading, I guess. Because like if you call a release date and then people pick it up, if they pick it up and somehow just do not read that it's early access somehow. And expecting a full game. They're not getting a full game out of this.
But it also kind of seems like strange to me because at some point this game is going to exit early access, right? And then like release date announcement for real this time or what? Like, I don't know. It just seems strange. Like it seems maybe short-sighted, but also I could see why it would get more eyeballs. So maybe it's not the worst idea. I don't know. But anyways, the key is that it's entering early access on September 24th. And then also on September 24th, the first paid DLC for Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader, Void Shadows. I said that weird. Void Shadows is being pushed back from August 8th to September 24th. And the more polished this game can get before adding content, the better in my mind.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think everyone who is familiar with Alcat agrees. You know, so obviously the reason stated is like they wanted to give the dev team several additional weeks to polish it up, and the reality is, and as someone has mentioned in the replies to on our social media, it's like they will also probably need several additional weeks after it comes out to continue polishing it up.
Unfortunately, that just is the reputation they have, and it is deserved. It just is.
I mean, they released highly complex, ambitious games. And they recently released a 1.2 patch that you go to that page of the patch notes of the 1.2 patch, and you just scroll down, and you're like, that's a lot of text and a lot of tweaks
like
and
improvements. 1,000 bullets on the bullet list. Yeah. I think we talked about that at the very end of the podcast 2 weeks ago. But, yeah. But yeah.
It's it continues to, you know, they're still cooking in there. Ryan, I don't know when's a good time to like play this game. I don't.
Just play it now.
No.
Ever.
You crazy?
Look, it's the most popular guide on Neo Seeker, okay? Surely lots of people are playing.
Oh, is it? Is it Rogue Trader?
Well, I remember Chao saying that about Wrath of the Righteous, too. It seems like these Owlcat games, like you said, very complex. People want guides.
What was the bounty?
I feel like there's very specifically like a genre of game, not just RPGs, but like specifically like PC focused like games that are super popular, but you just don't see a lot of conversation about. Because I remember for the longest time, it's like DJ Max Respect is huge on Steam, huge on PC, but outside of that niche, you don't really hear people talk about it, even though it's like massive.
That's what I feel about like Mountain Blade. Like Mountain Blade, I heard those games come out every once in a while, right? And it's like, yeah, they come out every once in a while and millions of people play it. Like, oh, like our spheres don't always intersect, you know. So sometimes you just gotta be cognizant of what your purview is.
Like Manor Lords, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Related, I was like, when's a good time to jump in? I'm like, speaking of, Wrath of the Righteous got 6 paid DLCs. Did those all finally release? Being, you know, RPG site, I should know this, but I didn't have it memorized. Yeah, the final Wrath of the Righteous DLC released a month ago in June. So I'm like, all right, maybe replay through that so you can see everything they added to it next time I find 100 hours of free. But yeah.
Just like PlayStation Plus members, they'll have hundreds of hours of free time when Wrath of the Righteous gets added to the service on July 16th.
There you go.
Yeah, boom, segue.
And that, I think, closes the loop, and we've covered everything on this podcast. You know, so not a big headline week, but we still got 2 hours out of it. So lots of talk about recent games, older games, you know, games that come to Steam, games that are just now released in English for the first time. And we're going to keep that on. And July and August, like we said, kind of quiet, relatively speaking, unless you've got A, a huge backlog, B, your individual novels, C, any other things, you know, it's never truly been quiet this year. And then in August, started going into October, it just starts to pick up again. Insanely, we got a new Mana game. We've got obviously a new Atlas game, new Atlas IP and Metaphor. And then a bunch of Mario RPGs that just got announced, or the Brothership and a few others in November. Yeah, so enjoy the lull while we have it, because it's not going to get any quieter from here on out. We do have all those articles that James wrote and wrote previews on the website, rpgsite.net. All the news of the week, Josh, and I think with a little bit of help from Adam and Kite, covered on the site at rpgsite.net. You can catch up on all those as well. You can find RPG Site on all the social media platforms. Just search for RPG Site and you should be able to find us. And with that, we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. Any other final comments or thoughts from the crew before we close out?
What's coming out next week?
There's several
indie games, actually.
Yeah, I know. I think currently going on right now is Billy Billy World. They don't stream it or anything, but it's a huge convention in China, in Shanghai.
I think the big two are Gestalt, Steam, and Cinder. That's an indie game that people have had their eye on for a while. It was really supposed to release in May, and it's coming out in a few days on July 16th. And then Flintlock, The Siege of Dawn, kind of like that double A European RPG. Is it European?
It's New Zealand.
Okay, I was going to say, like, I had something in the back of my mind saying, no, it's not a European, it's New Zealand. That coming out also on July.
And there's Dungeons of Hinterberg.
Yeah.
It's an indie game that's got some of the Xbox push behind it. And then also Riviera of the Promised Land comes to PC.
Let's go!
And then at the end of the month, in a couple of weeks, we have that sort of Convallaria kind of classic 16-bit inspired JRPG with a free to play and a like two different modes of gameplay that we talked about.
I'm really curious to see where it goes, because I don't know how it could be like successful, because it's like the whole PvP aspect is where they make their money from, while the entire single player is free. I just want to see how successful it becomes. At least that's for me.
Yeah, I guess you and I will check it out, Chao.
Yeah. I mean, for all I care, I mean, we could just beat all the single-player content. Just don't touch the PvP.
Exactly. Yeah, so Bilibili World is going on right now. Shueisha is going to have an event soon, I believe. A few days. I don't know if we'll have anything relevant to us. One to look out for. For Chao and I, Evo's starting up next weekend, Chao.
Damn, I thought it's today.
So it's next weekend. You excited?
Yeah, of course I'm excited. I'm rooting for Punk, okay?
You want Punk to take SF6?
Yeah. I wasn't tearing for Team China when he won that last tournament. I was tearing for Punk, actually.
I know it's not going to happen, but I want Idom to make top six, at least.
I feel like he has finally got over through his demons that he can never get like first place. It's always like second place, but I feel like he finally got through his demons from CEO. At least that's how I see it.
Or Punk?
Yeah.
There's a good chance. There's a good chance.
I just feel bad for this guy. It's like he like destroys like everybody, but he just can't seem to clutch the first place. You know,
I'm
just
very good. Yeah, I mean, anything can happen, man. I feel like anything can happen. It's hard to know who's going to be successful at Street Fighter VI at this point, because Season 2 and Bison just like changed everything.
Yeah,
I've been following the Panga League. That like it's crazy what the Japanese competition is like with this newest patch and Bison. Like you saw, Kakeru is like not on Bison. Crazy. Anyway, sorry for the brief fighting you. We're excited.
And we have one of those, so I think it's properly for us.
Okay, so I don't follow VR. Is there any interesting game in VR side of things for James?
Like I said earlier, there is like VR stuff coming out. Like I'm actually doing a review for another outlet for a VR game that's coming out next week. So it's like,
yeah,
it really is funny hearing, oh, this is the slow period when it's like Daybreak came out last week. And especially if you're at all into VR, it's like there is no slow period right now.
Yeah, this guy's always busy every month.
Well, if that covers everything, we'll end it here. We'll be back next week. Stay safe. Take care. I'll talk to y'all later.